KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Janice Bell has taught writing in the San Francisco Bay Area for over three decades. She recently published a book all about avoiding common errors in grammar and punctuation. And in the hour ahead, we'll find out what those errors are and how to correct them. We'll also find out how you can improve and enhance your own writing, as well as taking a look at to what extent good, effective writing has declined since the onset of the Internet. That's all coming up next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Janice Bell teaches writing and grammar in San Francisco at Golden Gate University and has been teaching English composition and grammar in the San Francisco Bay Area since 1973. She recently produced with Norton Press a nifty and often entertaining handbook. It's a guide to avoiding the most common errors in grammar and punctuation titled Clean, Well-Lighted Sentences, a title that, like the bookstore, takes its name from Hemingway's famous story, A Clean, Well-Lighted Place. What are clean, well-lighted sentences? Well, we'll find out about them in this hour and about some of the errors that you can avoid. And we welcome our guest, Janice Bell. Good morning, Janice.
Good morning.
We're going to talk a little bit, I had said, by way of promotion, about how maybe things have been made worse in writing through the Internet because everybody's sending text messages and emailing and all that. I said to Janice before we went on the air, and by the way, this covers a lot of errors, this book. Maybe there's more sanctioning of sloppiness, but the errors have been just as bad all these over 30 years that you've been teaching. They haven't even gotten worse, at least. Is that to say?
No, I can't say that they have. That's true.
That's positive. Okay. But nevertheless, there are errors here that you would think most people would take naturally. It would be a part of their, you know, elementary school training or something along those lines. I don't mean, you know, to be flip about it, but difference between affect and effect. I mean, these are things that you want to think people have drummed into them early on, but they don't.
Well, that's true, but I don't remember learning about affect and effect in elementary school.
Well, or things like it's with a punctuation mark at the end, which so many people do, meaning it's possessive when it's not possessive, as opposed to it is with a contraction. That's that kind of thing. I mean, these are kind of elementary things, really, you would think.
They are, and I suspect we did learn them at one point, or perhaps we did, but maybe we forgot, or maybe the way in which it was explained to, in the beginning didn't make that kind of sense to us. I don't know, but the errors persist.
Well, you want to explain these things, why they are rules, which is, and yet English can be very illogical, of course.
Why they are rules, and perhaps why we misunderstand what to do in certain situations. For example, IT apostrophe S versus ITS. I understand why people think that IT apostrophe S is possessive. We do use an apostrophe for possession. It just isn't that we use it with pronouns. We use it with nouns. So if we want to talk about John's hat, we know that the apostrophe shows that the hat belongs to John. So I imagine we just spread that over into the pronouns and we think that IT apostrophe S is also possessive because it has the apostrophe in it. But when you put it into a context and you take a look at all of our possessive pronouns, my, your, his, her, our, whose, its. Never mind the whose and the its because they do exist with apostrophes. But the others, my, your, his, her, there's no apostrophe. And everybody knows those are possessive. When you show people the list, look at all these words. They're all possessive and there's not an apostrophe among them. Then they get it.
Now, it's a kind of compulsive thing. You know, you think I'm going to put an apostrophe there because there are apostrophes with the other. And in fact, it's kind of the same thing with commas, it struck me. I remember Gene Grunt, a friend, a colleague of mine from many years ago, used to say there are students who are kamikazes, you know, which is a pretty good word, I thought. They want to put commas everywhere. And then there are students who don't know where a comma goes. I mean, but the rules are pretty crystal clear, actually, where you put a comma and where you don't put a comma.
They are if they're clearly explained in ways that people can understand. I mean, for example, you can look at some handbooks that tell you how to use commas, and you can find 9 pages on commas with a lot of grammatical words that people don't really understand. For example, they'll tell you that you put commas around an appositional phrase, or you put commas around an adjective clause that is non-restrictive. Oh, great. I mean, who's going to understand that? But if you look at what an appositional phrase or an adjective clause is, it's an interruption. If you tell people you put commas around an interruption, boom, they get it. It's a lot easier to understand. So I think the terminology in a lot of the handbooks throws people off.
Can really weigh you down. But
yes.
Also, there's a little confusion. You point out in your book that, like Time Magazine and New Yorker, have a different way of approaching that last comma and things that run three or more.
Yes.
So people can see, even in newsprint sometimes, things that will confuse them.
That's right.
What's the rule on that?
Well, the tradition is that you do use a comma after every item in a series, even the one that precedes and. But usage is divided. I mean, a lot of professional writers are choosing to leave out that last comma, the one before and others are choosing to put it in. I vote for putting it in. I think it lends clarity to your sentence, and I think it gives equal weight to all the items in the series, rather than suggesting that the last two are more closely related than the first two, for example.
Well, you also do something here that is continue to be a moot point for many people. You talk about agreement with pronouns, like anyone can find those papers if they have a bloodhound and a shovel. And anyone sounds singular because it is, and they sounds plural because it is, so mm-hmm. they shouldn't go together. So you can use the he, she, and yet some people are saying, well, it's okay to use the they now. It's almost common usage and so forth. You resist that?
It is common usage. I resist it in my own writing. I suggest to my students that they find alternatives. Whenever you're writing a sentence like that, you're generalizing. When you say anyone, it means anyone in the universe. And you got yourself into the bind because you chose a singular word to begin with, anyone. If you want, you can turn back and make that plural. Turn it into people can do something when they want to, rather than anyone can do something when she or he wants to. So, I mean, there are ways out.
Yeah, and there are kind of nifty ways that you provide for people of getting ways out of some of these situations, or at least making them remember the rules. I like, for example, when you go into the whole difference between lay and lie and try to lay it all out before us, and you say, are you thoroughly confused? Well, lay this book aside and lie down for a while. that's really very useful. You start the book with case, though. Why start with case?
It's smaller. It's simpler. Than the other issues that come up in the book. And yet there are lots of problems with case. And people are not understanding when to use I and when to use me and when to use myself. I mean, between you and I is so common, isn't it?
People use it all the time. Yeah.
Yes. And Smith, Jones, and myself worked on this project for a long time is also common. But, you know, when you take it apart, Smith worked on the project, Jones worked on the project, myself worked on the project. I mean...
But it's funny because it looks glaring to a grammarian much more than when you hear it. That's part of the problem. I mean, people use incorrect speech all the time, incorrect grammar and speech all the time, and
yes.
It's much more acceptable. There's much more tolerance toward it, it seems.
Well, and we're not looking at people's speech. You know, our eyes are not looking at it, and when people are speaking, they do so at their own pace, and we are forced to follow at their pace. When people are writing, or excuse me, when people are reading, they're taking more time, and they're looking at the words. And therefore, the way we're using language is more important and is judged more harshly, I think. People give us a lot of leeway when we speak. And as I say, they're just trying to keep up with us, too.
Well, and they don't give us leeway when we misspell words, although now with spelling corrections and, you know, spell checks and all those sorts of things, a lot of people don't necessarily pay the attention to misspelled words that perhaps they used to, or maybe they ought to. There's a lot of them here. In fact, you've got a whole list of them. But a lot of them also have to do with not only misspelled words, but misused words.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of the words that are misspelled because they're misused, or they're misused because they're misspelled. I mean, just a general observation, nothing beyond that. There's also a lot of confusion you write about with tenses, present and present perfect and past perfect and all of those kinds of things. Again, a lot of people are just put off by the nomenclatures, by the way they're designated and so forth. And they say, I don't necessarily know what those tenses are, but there's some shortcuts. There's some ease with understanding.
There are, and I thought about that when I wrote the book, how much grammar terminology to use, because it's off-putting, and it doesn't help people to learn what they need to know.
Is that off-putting? Is that grammatically correct?
It's putting off? It's alienating. And
so how do you get past that?
Well, I used only the terms that I felt were absolutely necessary. I mean, past and present aren't really going to confuse anybody. Past perfect, present perfect, what can I call them, hot dogs and hamburgers? Then somebody has to remember what a hot dog is and what a hamburger is in the context that I'm using it. So they may as well learn the terms over again. I use, as I say, as few grammatical terms as possible in this book. And when I use them, I explain them. And that's one of the differences about my book when you compare it to others, is that there's a minimal use of technical language. And when I have to use it, I do explain what it is.
So what's the main tense confusion that people need to know about, or that particularly you find as a writing teacher?
Yeah, there aren't that many points in the chapter on verb tense and usage, if you take a look at it, because native speakers of English do pretty well with tense, I have to say. Sometimes we misuse present perfect, which is using have as a helping verb, like, I have decided to come on the radio with Michael Krasny. Well, have decided, it doesn't work at all, because decided happens once. You make a decision. It's a completed past action. It's not something you do over time that perhaps may still be going on.
What we call an unnecessary auxiliary, right?
Well, if you want, I would never say that.
That's Jerry, because you're avoiding all the terminology, I thought I would throw some of it out.
No, but that's one of the problems that native speakers who know the language well and write well have. We use have done this, have done that, when we really mean we did it. Another area of confusion is that we don't distinguish past moments often. We act as if everything happened at the same moment in the past, using just simple past tense for everything, rather than specifying that something happened before another past moment. So she had done something before she did something else. We tend to leave out the had. We say she did this before she did that. And you might say, well, who needs it? You got the word before in there. That's true in that sentence. But sometimes the word before isn't in the sentence, and it's not clear when the two actions took place. So you're really not communicating as clearly as you want to be.
I'm talking to Janice Bell, author of Clean, Well-Lighted Sentences, and communicating as effectively as you want to be means clean, well-lighted sentences, or at least sentences that are balanced and sentences that are coordinated and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Parallel and clean. Avoid drunk and shrunk, you say.
Avoid them?
Yeah, I think so.
No, I'm telling people how to use them.
Well, but you're telling them to avoid them because they're so often misused. At least that was the implication I had. Aren't they?
No, I'm just saying that. No, I'm saying people do avoid drunk. Uh-huh, I know what you're remembering. Simply, I think, because it connotes alcohol. And so they will say, I had drank a lot of that, instead of I had drunk a lot of that. And even if they're referring to milk, they won't say, I had drunk a lot of milk. They'll say, I had drank a lot of milk.
Is it a drunk driver or a drunken driver, Judy wants to know?
I think it's a drank driver.
A drank driver? Yeah.
Anyway, I do think that's why people stay away from that. And I don't understand why they stay away from shrunk. I mean, they rely on shrank. I had shrank something. It had shrank. Oh, my goodness sake.
Thank you for interpreting for me. What I meant was the avoidance of those. By, mm-hmm. Yeah, and you had to read my mind on that because I didn't I misspoke myself. But there's so many things like this that suggest that people do things almost automatically without necessarily thinking it through or without thinking about the rule that's behind it. You write about modifiers, for example, and there's one point where you go in a whole section on only.
Oh, you know, that's one of my favorite things to know about in this universe. And practically whenever I turn the radio on, I hear a news broadcaster, excuse me, putting only in the wrong place. Driving here today, I heard somebody say that our economy will only improve when people stop spending so much, or when people start spending more. I can't remember which way it went, but I was so obsessed with the only. The person is saying it will only improve. And that really means that's all that will happen. That's all that can happen is that it will improve. But what the person meant to say is that it will improve only under a certain condition, only when people start spending or stop spending. As I say, I didn't even get the rest of the sentence. I was so derailed by the misplaced only. But we tend to throw it in too soon. We tend to say something like, I only want a synopsis, not a full report. I only want? Is that really what you're trying to convey? I only want, I'm just desiring, I'm hoping? No, you're trying to say I want only a synopsis, just a synopsis, merely a synopsis.
No, some of this is semantics. It's like the way Orwell, I think, in Politics and English Language talks about how people misuse the word unique. You know, mm-hmm. As opposed to meaning distinct and kind of sui generis, they'll use unique to just mean anything innovative or anything, you know, that's original.
Not to mention very unique, very one of a kind.
Yeah, very unique, right?
Yes, that's very common.
And here Janice says in her book, isn't it amazing how the meaning changes every time only hops to the right? Now, that's the kind of modifier I'd like to marry. It has no problem relocating, finds a new job immediately, and it loves the one it's with.
I'm in love with modifiers. It's my favorite chapter. It's my favorite topic.
Well, even your dedication says to all the modifiers in my life, right?
That's right.
Position themselves.
That's right. And those who've changed me and decorated me and stuck by me.
I'm often prompted to think how difficult English is as a language to learn, particularly if it's not your native language. And yet, as you say, the to-be verb is the only verb that really is, I mean, there are a lot of irregular verbs, but it's kind of, don't you kind of make the verbs down to a certain number and say, this is it, and we can just deal with it on that level?
Well, the only time I talk about the to-be verb is in the chapter that speaks of, and I don't want to talk dirty here, but it is called subjunctive mood. When you're speculating about something, if I were, if it were, if he were. And a lot of native speakers of English just don't get it, that you're supposed to be using were when you're speculating about something that's not probable. And yet there's a choice. In a sentence involving if, you can be saying that something is possible. For example, if I go to the meeting, I will bring up what I think is important. If I go to the meeting, I will bring up something. Versus, if I went to the meeting, I would bring up something. Now, nobody has a problem with any of the verbs. We automatically make them all past tense when we're saying, I'm not going to the meeting. If I went to the meeting, I would bring up something means I'm not going. And everybody gets it. We don't even know what we're doing as natives. We don't understand that we're using past tense to speculate about something that's not going to happen.
Well, I used to say, you know, try to teach somebody that in English you say first person singular, I speak, and then you turn it into the third person singular, he speaks, she speaks, add an S, right? And then you turn the third person plural, they speak, and you take off the S.
Yes.
I mean, there are those kinds
that
of
that can be confusing, but not for a native speaker. I mean, no. Native speakers get that. Let me finish. The only time we have a problem with a sentence that's speculating and speculating about something that's not going to happen or is improbable is when we have the verb to be. People are saying, if I was there, I would blah, blah, blah. If I was a lawyer, I would be better at blah, blah, blah. Well, it's never if I was. It's never if he was. It's never if she was when you're speculating about something that's not likely to happen. It's were. And in the book, in the chapter you're looking at, I'm telling people the only reason we have a problem choosing were is that that verb, the to-be verb, is the only one that has two forms of past tense. It has was and it has were. But every other verb has one form of simple past tense. You know, nobody has a problem with if I lived in Hawaii. Everybody knows that the past tense of live is lived. We automatically say, if I lived in Hawaii, I would be surfing. But when it's a being verb, we
then
get confused.
Then it causes confusion.
Exactly.
Yeah. And the subjunctive, as you've been saying, causes a good deal of confusion, too. But you boil things down nicely. You boil punctuation down to 9 rules, really. I mean, it's a lot better than Strunk and White does, I think. Reading a whole treatise on how the semicolon needs to be used more and how we're ignoring the semicolon, neglecting it, and it needs, you know, much more use, you agree? That we could make more use of the semicolon than we do or should make more use of it?
I wouldn't restrict that to the semicolon. I would say that most people use commas and periods only and that they're not using all the punctuation marks they could and they're inhibiting their own writing style because they simply don't know how to punctuate.
You mean like dashes and hyphens and colons?
Dashes and hyphens and colons and semicolons, right. Exactly. I mean, knowing how to use just the semicolon, the colon, and the dash can greatly enhance your writing style. Most people consider that their speaking style is more interesting than their writing style, and I have a theory that they're not writing a lot of sentences that they're able to speak simply because they don't know how to punctuate them.
Give us a rule on when to use dashes and when to use colons and hyphens.
Which one would you like?
Well, let's take them one by one. When's a good time to use a dash or not to use a dash, for that matter?
Well, dashes have three roles, in sentences. They can surround an interruption. They're not the only way to punctuate an interruption, but certainly it's one way to do so.
And you highlight it more with the dash in a way.
They give that interruption more attention, absolutely. So you have one at the beginning of the interruption and one at the end. If you have a simple sentence like, my daughter, Ramona, has an imaginary playmate. Ramona's an interruption. The main idea is my daughter has an imaginary playmate. You can surround that interruption in three ways, really, depending on the kind of attention you want to give it. Normal attention, you put commas around it. My daughter, comma, Ramona, comma. Minimum attention, you put parens around it. almost as if it's an aside comment, like everybody knows it's Ramona. So the parens achieve that. But if you really want the word Ramona to stand out and to get more attention than it otherwise would, you'd put a dash to the right and the left of it. And a dash, by the way, is twice as long as a hyphen. It's a very common mistake I see in the writing of students and people in business. They're writing my daughter hyphen Ramona hyphen, thinking that they've used dashes if they even dare to try. A hyphen is something altogether different.
Well, tell us about a hyphen.
Well, hyphens connect descriptive words that need each other in order to create the meaning you want. For example, the blue-eyed boy. Blue-eyed is descriptive, of course, telling you about the boy. Yet neither of those words works on its own. He's not a blue boy. He's not an eyed boy. We could say he's an eyed boy, but you never would say he's an eyed boy if he didn't have blue there. So when you try each of those adjectives by itself with the upcoming boy, and they don't work alone, well, they need each other, and we use a hyphen to connect them. But English is so screwy. That's... We connect them only when it's to the left of the boy.
Yeah, right.
When we say the boy is blue-eyed, we don't connect them. So, you know, go figure.
And we're talking about colons as well. When do you best use colons?
You know, most people understand one thing about a colon, that you put it on the page when you have items in a series coming up. And that's about all they really know. And yet the colon story is so much larger than that and more beautiful, really. First of all, a colon means, I know I just generalized, but I'm about to specifically explain what I meant. So that what happens after a colon can be anything. You're home free after a colon. You can write one word, you can write a phrase, you can write what could be a whole other sentence, and of course you can write items in a series. But it's perfectly allowable and admirable, in fact, to use a colon even when one word follows it. For example, this morning for breakfast, I had my favorite cereal, colon, Wheaties, period. Now, people are reading that kind of sentence in the good writing they're reading all the time, and yet it's not translating into their writing habits. They're not understanding that they can put a colon right before Wheaties and then end the sentence.
Talking to Janice Bell, who's the author of Clean, Well-Lighted Sentences, a guide to avoiding the most common errors in grammar and punctuation. By the way, there are all these sentences that give you examples throughout the book, as well as quizzes at the end of each section. We have sections that take us through verbs and take us through modifiers and case and tense and agreement, all of these things, until we get to the point where Ms. Bell says, well, we've covered everything else. What's left? It's the glue. It's the connectives. And by the way, you can end a sentence with a, I almost said proposition, with a preposition. You know, Winston Churchill said, that is something up with which I will not put.
Exactly.
You know, the idea that you're never supposed to end a sentence with a preposition. So there are all kinds of useful clues and rules like that, including what so many students particularly find difficult, which is where to put punctuation when you have something in quotation marks and where quotation marks belong.
Yes, yes, yes.
Want to go through the rules for us, quickly?
Oh, well, I'll tell you something that will be very useful in your life, that if you've got a quotation and you're about to type the closing quotation mark, and it's also time to type a comma or a period, the comma and the period belong inside 100% of the time. Don't think about it. It doesn't look logical. That's the way it is. I think that the publishing industry imposed that rule on us about 40 years ago, but that's the way it is. And yet, when it's time for a semicolon or a colon, it goes outside.
A lot of rules, and a lot of, some of them don't make sense, but a lot of them are certainly useful to you if you want to write clean, well-lighted sentences. That's what Janice Bell's book is all about. She's been teaching grammar and English composition for over 3 decades here in the Bay Area. And you are welcome to join us if you have questions about grammar, punctuation, common errors that you make or that others make. Call us. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or send an email to forum@kqed.org. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Janice Bell, who has put a book out with Norton called Clean, Well-Lighted Sentences, a guide to avoiding the most common errors in grammar and punctuation that comes from well over 3 decades of experience. And this was fun writing this book for you, huh?
It was a lot of fun. It was the best part of the whole process, just writing the book.
Well, you've always had a little of the comedian in you. I've known you many years. You've brought that to bear, certainly, in many of the sentences and the like that you use as examples. But there is a sense about this that's quite serious. I mean, to try to and still people with the importance of writing, as you call them, clean, well-lighted sentences. And yet there's a lot of sloppiness out there, and there's a lot of apathy, too.
There is. Using language well, writing well, is extremely important to how you're perceived. In what way do people know who we are? I mean, the way you wear your hat, the way you sip your tea, the way you dance your salsa, yes, those tell people something about you. But the way you use words, and especially on a page, indicates how you think, indicates your intelligence, indicates your knowledge level, your education. And that's pretty important.
It's funny, too, how you can see a very common error, like some of the ones that you cover here, in an otherwise important document or letter that's addressed to you or so, and that sort of thing. And, you know, right away, there's a kind of Pavlovian response. You recoil, and somehow you don't want to think less of the person, but something happens sometimes.
Yes, something
chemically
happens,
almost,
and it's often unconscious. When we read writing that's not correct, you know, when we read, we want to understand, certainly. We're inclined to understand. We hit one glitch. We hit one error. We hit another gaffe. We see a punctuation mark that makes us respond unconsciously in a certain way because we know how to read punctuation. We know what to do when we see the marks. And yet we continue in the sentence and we have done the wrong thing. The writer made us do the wrong thing because the mark wasn't correct. And little by little, we're losing respect. We're losing respect for the ideas. And we're getting distracted because what the writer has tried to communicate keeps getting interrupted.
Well, we got interrupted on a few things before I get to calls, and that is a caller wanted to get to the other two uses of the hyphen, but also rules for semicolon and colons that you didn't get to.
Okay.
When we were talking before.
It was the other two uses of the dash, actually.
I'm sorry, the dash, yeah.
So the first use was to surround an interruption. Another use of the dash is to lead to an afterthought, to separate the main idea from the afterthought. And the third use of the dash is exactly the use of a colon. So when you have just written a general statement and you're now planning to specifically explain it, you may certainly use a colon or you may use a dash. It's an alternative. Now, one can say, well, why would I want to use a dash if I could use a colon? I think that colons are a little bit more formal than dashes, and I think it has to do with the fact that they are vertical on the page rather than horizontal. They make, like a gate, they make a stop and pay extreme attention to what's coming up next. Dashes kind of slide you right along into the explanation, so I think they're a little bit less formal. Also, for variety, maybe you used a colon two sentences ago and you don't want to come in with another colon, so use a dash this time. Anyway, those are the other two uses of the dash. And what was the other question?
Good rules. The old distinction between semicolons and commas. And colons.
Uh-huh. Well, as I said, the colon, of course, leads to a specific and complete explanation. A semicolon is different. A semicolon says to the reader, that's half the story, sweetheart. Here's the other half. And the other half is neither more general nor more specific. It's on the same level as the first idea. So if you say, I enjoy wearing cashmere sweaters, and that's half the story. Here's the other half of the story. My sister abhors them, you know. So one half is I like this, my sister doesn't.
Let's find out what our callers want to know or say here. Vicki, you're first up. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I have a question about the use of an apostrophe. So last night I was having dinner at a friend's house, and there was a box of Trader Joe's Cheerios on the counter. And it says Joe's O's, and it's a capital O and an apostrophe S. And we thought, that doesn't show possession, but at the same time, it would say Oz if it didn't have an apostrophe. So we were wondering what the correct usage is there.
That's a good question, and it is confusing for writers. It used to be traditional that when you're trying to make a letter or a numeral plural, you would put the apostrophe before the S. For example, if I say that I received 3 A's on my report card and I don't put that apostrophe before the lowercase s, it looks like as.
Right.
Yes, exactly. And so to clarify that we're talking about the letter A and we're making it plural and we're not forming the word as or oz, as you said, we do put the apostrophe in.
Oh, okay, because it's the same thing with like the Oakland A's.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, exactly.
But when you're talking about 2 MBAs, for example, then it wouldn't be necessary. You still could follow the rule, but you don't have to because there would be no confusion using a lowercase s after the 3 capital letters MBA.
Well, the world, and thank you for the call, Vicki, the world of advertising has helped confuse us in many instances. I remember all the arguments over Winston tastes good like a cigarette should, and you get it to like an as.
I think that was deliberate. I really do. I think that ad got more attention than had it been phrased grammatically correctly to begin with. I don't think it would have even been noticed.
Interesting hypothesis. Well, let me get more of our callers, and we'll go to Sylvia next. Sylvia, you're on. Hi.
This really bugs me. Why do people, even professional writers, say an historic house? We certainly don't say an heavy box, or I walked up an hill. Why do people put an instead of a in front of historic?
Well, it has to do with pronunciation. When we pronounce the H as in house and we can hear it, then, of course, we're not inclined to use an. And yet some people pronounce historic without that audible H. So when they're using an, you're not going to hear the H. It's an historic house. And I think that's more British, actually, than American. But
that bugs you, Sylvia, right? I mean, it's funny how some of these things can really be pet peeves, major pet peeves. We'll hear from some more of our listeners. Let's go to Susan. Good morning.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm loving this level of detail. My children call me the grammar police, but I'm not sure it's a compliment.
But it is. It is. You should tell them thank you every time.
I do, with a smile. One thing that always confuses me is the distinction between the words lie and lay, and I'm not sure when to use each.
I alluded to that before. You want to run the rule down for us, Janice?
Yes, I don't know how much you really want to hear, but I'll try to make it...
Lay it down.
...succinct. Lay it down. Well, they're very separate verbs in a couple of ways. Lie is not supposed to be followed by anybody or anything. So you lie down. But when you are putting something down or putting someone someplace... Then we use the word lay. So you lay the baby down. You lay the blanket on the bed. You lay the flowers on the table. So when there's a baby or flowers or a blanket coming up, the verb you need is lay. When there's nobody and nothing coming up, the verb you need is lie. That's the first distinction. The other one that drives native speakers crazy, and probably non-native speakers too, is how they get conjugated. The area of confusion that... has to do with the way lie in particular is conjugated. It's lie, lay, lane. So today you lie down, yesterday you lay down, L-A-Y, which of course is in common with the present tense of the other verb.
Makes no sense.
No, it doesn't make any sense. But, and in the past, before you lay down, you had lain down, L-A-I-N. It gets even worse. You just have to memorize it. It's never going to sound right. Lie, lay, lane is what you do when you put your body on the couch. Lay, laid, laid, L-A-I-D, is what you do when you're putting flowers on the table. Or when a chicken is doing something with its egg.
Got it, Susan?
That helps. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you. Well, she's with the grammar police, so it'd be easy for her to assimilate. Michael, join us. Morning.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for the program.
Sure.
I have a question. Actually, I had two questions, but lay, and lane was the first question. The other question I have is there a specific rule against ending a sentence in a contraction? For instance, is it grammatically correct to say, grammatically speaking, you are not as lazy as I'm?
I've never seen that, to tell you the truth. I wouldn't do it.
It just doesn't sound right.
It's a matter of style, really.
I know it never sounds right, and I can't think of an example where it does sound right, but I've never stumbled across an actual rule that says you can't do it.
You might, if you were in the South, you might end it with yourn, but I think I'm doesn't work in the instance that you gave.
I don't think there's a rule about ending a sentence in contractions. For example, there's nothing the matter with saying or writing, no, I can't, and there's a contraction for you.
No, that's very true. Very true.
Yeah, but the example you gave just...
No one would do it.
Yeah, I don't think.
I've never heard it. I've never seen it.
Yeah.
I think the point of it is just to actually have it sound weird and still be grammatically correct. But
yeah.
Thanks so much for the program. It's much appreciated.
Thank you for the call. And let's go to Steve in Sassoon City. Hi, Steve.
Hi there. I'm a science writer for an internet site called thunderbolts.info, picture of the day. And because I write somewhat technical articles, I endeavor to write precisely. The biggest problem I have is with commas. My co-editor corrects me all the time, and I wonder, is there a rule I can use that will help me with this?
Well, yes, you definitely need to get my book. I'm telling you, the whole last chapter's on punctuation, and especially with commas, it answers the most common questions I have heard for the last 35 years. A lot of handbooks give you so many rules about commas that you can't remember the first one when you're on the 19th. I divide the use of commas into four categories, and they're pretty easy to follow. Everybody knows that you use commas between items in a series when you have three or more. That's the first time a comma is called for. A comma is also an option to the left and the right of an interruption, as I was saying earlier. That's the second time. There are two other sentence types that call for commas. One is the sentence that does not open up with the main idea. It opens up with something introductory. And that could be one word, like however, comma. It could be a phrase, like while driving to the studio, comma. Or it could be an introductory clause, like an introductory whole idea. For example, if I win the lottery. So after an introductory word or group of words, you'll have a comma. If you take that sentence, the one that starts with an introduction and then the main idea, and you flip it over, you've got a main idea and an afterthought. And that's another spot for a comma, right after the main idea to separate it from the afterthought. So those are the four types of sentences: items in a series, interruption, introductory element, afterthought. It's really not that complicated.
Sounds like you've got some ammunition here, Steve.
Huh? Well, I used to read a lot of 19th century literature, and they used commas proliferately, if I can use profligately. I don't know what the correct word is.
Not the first one you used.
Yes. They proliferated. So I always get confused because this 19th century method is still ingrained in me. So anyway, thanks for the help.
Welcome to the 21st century,
yes.
Steve, and thank you for the call. And we'll go to more of your calls. We'll go to Judy next. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I have two questions, but the first one is when to use who versus whom. And I'm wondering,
talk about common errors. Huh?
Yes. And I'm wondering, does your book also include diagramming sentences which would help parents with children and their learning?
No, my book has no diagramming, but I assure you that my book is going to help parents with teaching their children how to write better. It's very plain. It's very clear. There's lots of explanation. There are lots of examples. It's lighthearted. Even your kids are going to love it. Probably your kids will like it more than you. Let me get to your who and whom. Most of the time when we're at a point in a sentence, when that question comes up, we're at the beginning of a clause. Now, don't get scared with that word. A clause is simply a group of words that has a subject and a verb. And I always tell people to start at the word who or whom, we don't know what you're choosing yet, and read through the rest of the idea, the rest of the clause. Find the action, find the verb. Is there a word doing that action? Starting with the word who or whom, is there anybody else doing that action? If there's nobody else doing that action, then you need who. Because the word who has to be a subject for an upcoming verb. That's its job in life. When there's another word doing the action, another person doing the action, another thing doing the action, then that action doesn't need who, because we don't have two subjects for the same verb, not in this instance. So, for instance, the candidate who seems the most appealing to me is Joe Blow. Who seems? That's a who situation because seems, the action word, has no subject unless we provide one, the word who. But if I were to say the candidate whom I voted for, starting with the whom, if I look to the right and I find the verb voted, I see that there is somebody else doing that action. I voted. So that verb voted already has a subject. The word who is out of a job. You start that clause with whom. Does that make sense?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. That was easy. We'll get more of your calls on. Gary, hi. And so many people confuse who and whom. It's unbelievable. Go ahead, Gary. You're on.
Yes. I teach English as a second language in a foreign country, and I've run across a problem that I can't find any solution to. I tell my students to avoid this situation. Namely, when you end a sentence with an abbreviation, like, I'm going to Washington, D.C., and that D.C. takes a period after it, well, does that period serve as a double function to also end the sentence, or do I have to do something ridiculous like put two periods?
No, we never put two periods. That's something we never do.
Okay.
So it's always one period, and that's it.
Okay, so it has a double function then.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's confusing, like you said, for people who are learning English. Thank you. Let me go to some emails here. Here's Danny. He pled guilty. Is that English?
Sounds like it to me.
Yeah. Amy, what's with the recent development of everyone saying the thing is, even the thing was is? It's driving me nuts, she says. And that's for a linguist, linguistic expert to figure how these things come in idiomatically and how they kind of take over.
Hybrid reward.
Dean writes, I've been curious to know which of the following two phrases is correct. The exact same, exactly the same.
Hmm. They sound alike to me.
Yeah, they do to me too. Okay, let me get more callers on here. Michael, your turn. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Okay, thank you.
I have a couple of quick questions. One has to do with the naming of the tenses, like the past perfect, et cetera. I've never been able to get down which is which, although I'm very good at using them. And I started thinking about them as continuing tenses. In other words, phrases that begin in one time, the past, and move into the present, or in the present and move into the future, like I will have been here for 3 days tomorrow. What do you think of them as continuing tenses? Or do you have a better method of remembering the names for them?
No, it's just something I've memorized, and it really isn't necessary to know the names for them, as you indicate, unless you're teaching them. But did you say you're teaching English as a second language?
No, I'm not a teacher. I travel internationally a lot, and I wind up teaching a lot of professionals and engineers where English is not their primary language how to make these structures.
I see. I would avoid calling them what they're really called. I would tell people that when you're using have as a helping verb, here's what it means. And when you're using had as a helping verb, here's what it means.
What do you think of thinking of them as continuing tenses? In other words, phrases that move from one time, one tense to another.
Well, sometimes that's true and sometimes it isn't. I mean, it is true with have been teaching, but it isn't true with had taught, for example. So it works for some of them.
All right. And the other thing I wanted to ask you was, pet peeves of misused phrases like for all intensive purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you have a good list of those or a few you'd like to mention?
No, I don't think I have any of those. I have common errors that do not wind up being other words, like intensive instead
right.
of intense.
And also things like people confuse constantly, like imply and infer, and those sorts of things.
Yes, some confusion.
Oh, definitely. One of the things that really drives me crazy is the misuse of he holds his cards close to his chest, which it really should be vest. And you see that all the time. Although, of course, the vest and the chest are awfully close to each other.
Yes, they are. Thank you for the call, Michael. There's all these modifier people saying in regards to or more importantly or use of good versus well or less versus fewer. I mean, again, these are really everyday mistakes. And also in writing, a lot as opposed to just one word versus two words, which is so common.
Yes.
Let me get some more calls on. Ruth joining us from Point Reyes. Hi, Ruth.
Hi-ho. I find it very grating to hear a newscaster say, we will be back momentarily, when they really should be saying momently or in a moment.
Momently would sound pretty weird to my ear.
Well, yeah, it's pretty obscure, but in a moment, because momentarily means very briefly.
Well, perhaps that's what they mean.
No, they don't. We're going to take a commercial. We'll be back momentarily.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Well, you never hear that on this program. We don't do commercials,
no.
though.
No,
that's why. Thanks, Ruth. Let me get Jane on. Hi, Jane.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. One of the things that just drives me crazy among my whole list of stuff is when I go to a restaurant and I hear people, when they order, say, can I get, instead of may I have. I tutor at San Quentin, and one of the problems I have with my students, and most of them are Spanish as a first language, is words ending in a vowel as opposed to a consonant, and they will pronounce the word baked, for B-A-K-E-D, as baked. But clean...
Well, it goes with naked, right?
Right. Instead of baked. In other words, there's a T sound at the end of the past tense of bake, but there's a D sound at the end of the past tense of the word clean. And it's very difficult for me. I don't speak Spanish, and it's hard to explain to somebody who doesn't speak English why you don't pronounce baked as baked.
There's a word to use, Jane, that could be very instructive. It's loco. I mean, these rules are crazy. They don't make any sense. Yeah, they really are. So
I also ask you about consortium. Is it consortium or consortium? And the SSIONs and the TIONs, I hear all the time pronounce them not as shun, but as they pronounce the individual letters. Could you talk about that? And contractions they have a problem with. Heed, H-E apostrophe D, I have a difficult time explaining what a contraction is. And then once I explain it, then they will use he did instead of heed, even though he's reading H-E apostrophe D.
Yeah, these are good examples of what can be terribly confusing to non-native speakers. Very confusing. Some comments, Janice?
Well, most of them pertain to pronunciation.
Yeah.
And that's quite a challenge. I admire you for even attempting it. But it's not what my book
covers. It's not written
certainly.
Language.
No, it's not written language, yeah.
And yet, Jane, carry on, and thank you for the call. I'm glad you brought all that up. We're going to go to Jane next, another Jane, this one in Foster City. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I have two questions. One is a pronunciation question on the word formidable. Both my dictionaries list that as the first choice instead of formidable, which is what I hear all the time.
You often hear words that are second in line used more first choice by people. And again, this is pronunciation. Janice's book is really about writing sentences, but there's no way to correct that. Things get into common usage. I'm just talking here with my own kind of hat, but
yeah.
They get into common usage and they stay.
And the other one is use of the subjunctive, the if I were king thing, using the plural instead of the singular.
Now, that's right in Miss Bell's backyard, yeah.
If I were what?
If I were king, you use the were instead of was.
Oh, you're calling the were plural. I thought you made the king plural.
Oh.
well, were isn't plural when you're talking about subjunctive mood. Were is for every single subject. If I were, if you were, if he were, if it were, if they were, if we were, no matter who, everybody gets were. And that indicates not number, not whether the subject is singular or plural, but it indicates that what you're talking about is not happening or it's improbable.
But you hear people, again, in common usage speech, I was going.
Yes.
We were going. And then they'll say, we was going, which,
yes,
of course, is so grammatically incorrect,
yes,
that your ears stand up. But
and were isn't always plural. If you, used in the singular sense, is used in the singular sense, that also goes with were. You were.
Thank you for the call, Jane. And let's hear next from Andrea. Is it Andrea or Andrea?
Andrea.
Andrea, hi.
Hi. I see the word persons used all the time, and I thought it person was singular, and it shouldn't be pluralized, and you should use people instead, but I'm not quite sure.
I've seen it, too, mostly on buses and above the doors of bars.
No
more than persons 18 years or older, right?
Right.
I suspect that it's an older usage, and it's not common these days in the way we ordinarily write and speak. I can't call it wrong. I just say it's a little old-fashioned.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for the call. Next caller is joining us from Colorado, Mancos, Colorado. Nathan, hi.
Hi. Hey, I'm actually a builder, and on the construction site, it's a pretty rare place to find people debating grammar. However, we've been debating the word irregardless. We've got actually a general contractor that uses it all the time, and I wanted to know if irregardless is, if there is such a word, and when is the right time. As opposed to regardless?
There's never a right time to use it unless you're debating it on a construction site. That's what I would say. You know what?
Irregardless is not a word.
Well, listen.
No, it's in the dictionary.
It's in the dictionary, yeah. But it's in the dictionary as ain't is in the dictionary, as an error. What's happening with that word is that you're putting a negative meaning to it twice. Ear means without and less means without. So you're saying without regard.
No double negatives.
Exactly. So regardless or irregard?
No. Forget irregard. It's regardless.
Yeah. Okay. And one quick fun question. How would you write the sentence, there are three ways to write the word to?
In other words, how would you spell the last word?
Yes.
My goodness. You got me.
That would be one of those like he slash she. There are three words, and then you just have slash slash and write the word three different ways. That's a good little riddle there, Nathan. Thank you for that. I'm going to go to Alameda. Anna, hi.
Hi. I'm just debating about the correct use of the word importantly. I hear people say most importantly, and I think to myself they should be saying it's most important.
I wholeheartedly agree with you. Bravo. But you know what? Usage is divided among good speakers, good writers, and the most intelligent people in our nation. Half are saying most importantly. The other half are saying most important. An explanation of why I think it should be most important is that the expression is short for here's what's most important. That's what it means. Whether it's more important or most important, there really is no need for the L-Y. And yet, as I say, there are good speakers and writers who stick that L-Y on the end.
There are a lot of rules like that in the book that really clarify and that really take you to the heart of or the core of understanding why some of these rules are logical, though, as we've been saying, not all of them are. And there are some things that are irregular that just necessitate memory, and that's simply the way things are. The book, again, is Clean, Well-Lighted Sentences. The author's Janice Bell, and the subtitle is A Guide to Avoiding the Most Common Errors in Grammar and Punctuation. Janice, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Michael.
We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to remind you that we welcome any thoughts you have about what you hear on Forum or suggestions about what you'd like to hear. Questions or comments, you can simply email us, forum@kqed.org, or call our listener call-in line, 415-553-3300. We'll be back with you on the morrow. We do appreciate your being with us here for Forum, which again comes to you live 9 to 11 in the morning and an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers are Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. And our engineer is Danny Bringer. Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.